Welcome back to Planet Waves FM's continuing coverage of the United Astrology Conference in New Orleans, Louisiana. My name is Eric Francis, the host of Planet Waves FM, here on our third or fourth or so day of coverage of this event. And actually, I've been correcting that. It's really coverage of the people at the event. We're not really doing much with the conference itself, though. I guess we're going to have one of the Vedic lectures. Is going to be they're borrowing a piece of my equipment to record that, so we'll have that. And then the media panel is also on the queue. That's really the only official conference event that we have reposted. Although we will be soon putting up the entire day of the writing panel, the writing discussion in the morning that I did on Wednesday, and then Donna Woodwell following up with her discussion of how to use social networking and the internet as a way to propagate your astrology business and your ideas about astrology. So we're going to put that whole workshop, morning session and the afternoon session, on the net, though it might not be during the conference, but it will be fairly soon after, if not. My guest at the moment is a gentleman named Jim Chavon. What town in California are you from, Jim?
Currently Lemon Grove, which is a suburb of San Diego.
All right. So currently from Lemon Grove, California. He knows that location is temporary, transient. Jim is one of my favorite people in the astrology community. First of all, he's an avowed anarchist, the organized kind, which is a beautiful thing. And I read his newsletter every month, and that's a good, fun read. Sign up for that one. We'll put the web address. Jim's work came to my attention in 2000 when Jim attained some, as I said before, 15 minutes of world fame for predicting what was going to happen in the election of 2000. And I don't know if you're a predictive astrologer, but you seem to just be reading. Okay, so reading the chart, and you saw that Mercury retrograde station direct in the last degree of Libra on election day. And basically, if I recall correctly, you said that it would be very close, it would hang in the balance, there would be a delay in the election results. Did you bring up any fraud? Did you anticipate
fraud? I mentioned the possibility of fraud. I certainly mentioned or implied that there would be accusations of fraud and that absentee ballot counting would be an issue.
Now, how do you – let's talk about the absentee. So Jim is the one – and you were interviewed by whom? By TMA or was it a newspaper?
No, what I did was I – well, let me give you the background. Earlier that year, we had had an ESAR conference with a panel with 16 astrologers. 8 of them said Bush was going to win, and 8 of them said Gore was going to win. So I realized there was a problem here. So I'm going along with this as the background in my unconscious, and then – about a week and a half before the election, I look at the ephemeris and I go, shit, that's election day. That Mercury's going to go direct.
Yep.
So I'm a Mercury-ruled person. I was born on a direct station of Mercury 6 hours before. And I'm very sensitive to Mercury. And I know what happens when Mercury is very slow. Things get screwed up. So I said, how can an election be screwed up by Mercury? Well, elections are about counting votes. So reasoning, QED, there was going to be a problem with counting votes. So I sent out an email to about 50 astrologers, and Jeff Jower and Rick Levine on their website out of the Pacific Northwest picked it up and put it on their site, which gave it traction. And so that was how I became known for that prediction. Now, it turns out there were also 3 other American astrologers who made the same prediction, except none of us knew about each other. But I got all the traction from it because transiting Uranus was on my part of fortune at the time.
Right. So you had a spontaneous eruption of notoriety there.
That's right.
Awesome. So that was pretty good. Now, for only the second time in American history, there's going to be a Mercury station on the day of a presidential election. A friend of mine checked the Mercury station tables and checked all the presidential elections and cross-referenced. He's a thorough, copious guy. I haven't done that research myself, but I do trust AstroDems. I know him pretty good, and he pointed it out to me with an email with the subject header, spoiler alert. And that's when I figured out he was a good astrologer. But I'm still trying to figure out what the spoiler is now. But the news as brought by AstroDem is that there has only been one other Mercury station on the day of a presidential election, and that was the day that W was not elected in 2000 and took office.
Well, now, he won by 5-4, you know.
Yeah. had a clear majority of the Supreme Court saying that
That's right.
Yeah, they should stop the vote count, yes. Okay, so now we've got that happening again, and it seems a bit ominous. I mean, if anything's ominous, it's going to be that kind of a thing. And it's stationing retrograde this time,
right.
Not direct, and it's at midday, not at the very end of the polls being open, which as it was in 2000. What is your take on that?
I think those are subtleties which may not be totally relevant. I think we're going to see possibly a delay in results, somewhat like we saw in 2000, but it could even go longer, because in 2000 it took them 35 days to settle the issue. This time we've got the whole Mercury retrograde period plus the shadow afterwards.
Right.
So I think it could go well into December.
Right, where there's just not going to be a known or acknowledged winner. That's the kind of holding on that we're going to see.
Right.
From this.
Then you know about the election of 1876?
I don't know about that one.
It was a predecessor for this kind of thing. It was also resolved by Florida, or about the issue of counting votes in Florida. It was Hayes versus Rutherford B. Hayes won versus Samuel Tilden, who lost. But they say that Tilden probably won the popular vote and probably should have won the electoral.
I see, right. And now this, I'm looking at the chart right now, it's stationing retrograde at 4 and change of Sagittarius, which means it's going to go into Scorpio. It means it's hovering around the Sibley chart's ascendant.
Well, I'm not a fan of the Sibley chart.
If you're not a fan, even after 9/11, even with those angles coming up with the Uranus-Pluto opposition to the degree.
I can show you with David Solti's chart. For the Articles of Confederation.
You're a Scorpionic, you prefer Scorpionic America.
I prefer Scorpionic America chart, and I can show you how 9/11 works on that chart.
Right. Yeah, I knew David and love David and really like that chart. So I do acknowledge that as one of the valid charts of the United States.
Yeah.
The Sibley chart, just digressing for a second, did not get my attention until I saw that that Saturn-Pluto opposition angular to the degree. The Sibley chart are commonly today accepted ascendant as 12.5 degrees of Sagittarius.
Yeah.
And Saturn and Pluto were there on the day of the presidential daily brief on August 6th, 2019. What the hell year was it? 2001?
2001, yeah.
Right. So on that aspect was exact on 8601, and the events were set in motion, and it was exactly on the angles, the horizon angles of the Sibley chart. That's what finally got my attention about the Sibley chart.
Well, there are whole historical problems about the Sibley chart. Sibley had no idea, apparently, what the time of the actual event was in Philadelphia. He was using a technique based upon taking the angles of the chart done on the previous solstice or equinox and putting the event planets into those angles.
Right, so he was using a technique to develop that chart. But isn't
right.
But Rodden's page says it's based on a time written down in the Raphael's ephemeris of a contemporary astrologer, like sometime in the afternoon.
Well, the evidence that I've seen for the 1776 July 4th chart points to sometime early in the morning. And there's a rectification that's been done independently by James Borer, Zipporah Dobbins, and Michael Mankasi.
Is that the Virgo rising chart?
That's the Virgo rising
chart. And there are some people really passionate about that Virgo rising chart who feel it really explains the United States in a way that the Sibley chart does not quite.
Yeah, if you interview Michael Mankasi, you'll hear that case.
All right. Well, you know, he may be the guy who's been writing to me and saying, you really should try the Virgo rising chart. So now that you're saying that there's a consensus forming, I will take a look at the Virgo rising. Maybe for my July 4th tribute to the U.S. charts. I usually do one every year.
Also look back to July 2nd, 76, when the vote for independence was actually taken. July 4th was when they passed the final wording to send to the printer.
Right.
And go back 1 year earlier, 1775, when they declared war on George III.
Right.
All very important charts.
Okay. And then 1777, the chart you're talking about by David Solte, is the signing of the Articles of Confederation.
Actually, the passage by the Continental Congress of
right.
the Articles. It wasn't all, it didn't become officially the United States until a few more years went by and all the states, enough states had ratified it. the articles.
But as he explained it to me, that it was the first time that the separate states had joined together as a union rather than the 13 states declaring war against the king as separate entities.
Right. The French wanted to help the American colonists. The French were not willing to deal with 13 separate states. In order to get aid from the French, they had to have a single government that could negotiate with the French. That was the real motivator, according to Solti. And I think he's right.
I see. Okay. All right, good one. All right, so learn a little bit more about that to add to my repertoire. And you may be getting an email from me the last week of June in time for my July 4th chart article. Going to be a lot going on that week, though. Good heavens. All right, so how do we get on to... we got onto that by the date of the presidential election, and you said you're not a fan of the Sibley chart, and when I said that Mercury is stationing retrograde in the rising sign of the Sibley chart, Sagittarius. But that means it's going to back into Scorpio.
Right.
And what's it going to do while it's there? What is it going to do? It's going to make a conjunction to the... It's going to make an eclipse. There's an eclipse going on in the middle of all that, that Mercury is going to be mixed up in the middle of. I'm looking at the node near the sun, near the node with the moon rapidly approaching. So this is going to be pretty chaotic by all indications.
Oh, yeah. It's going to be a mess. It's going to make 2000 look simple.
That's not good.
No, it's not good. You mean a lot of unhappy political addicts.
Well, yeah, and then they're also going to get to see something special happen. I think that's the upside if you're a politics addict, is that you're going to see what's going on inside of Pandora's box here.
Yeah, about time.
Yeah, exactly. No, most political addicts are hooked on the surface layer. I mean,
right.
I don't even see my favorite political commentator in the mainstream politics is Maddow, Rachel Maddow. She gave me her data, by the way. I can send it to you for your mundane files. But if that's where you'd put it, I consider her a mundane phenomenon in some ways. But she does not go below the surface, really.
That's
she does not say, let's look at this. She gets the closest, but she doesn't say, look at this whole game and the way that it's a game of good cop, bad cop, and why is Obama so similar to Bush? What is he doing signing the National Defense Authorization Act and giving us some bullshit signing statement saying that he will not invoke that? He personally won't take any Americans hostage and render them to Northern Ireland. He'll just wait for the next president to do that, is basically what he said. As long as I'm president, that's not going to happen.
Yeah, but he also did kill American-born people over in Yemen with directly ordered hits.
Yes. Yeah, and as I pointed out in my sort of lukewarm endorsement of Obama, was that basically they're going to take a clean-cut kid and make a killer out of him, as Bob Dylan said. They're taking a guy with pretty much had no blood on his hands, and now he's got to be a murderer. He's got to sit down in that desk and kill people, no matter who it is. I wouldn't take the decision to kill bin Laden or quote unquote bin Laden lightly, even though he's considered a bad person. That's
well,
not light. You're endangering everybody else with him.
I'm sorry. In the version of history that I understand, bin Laden had nothing to do with 9/11.
I don't believe he did either.
And he was dead by the end of the year 2001.
I would agree with that as well, that he was suffering serious kidney disease and he was merely a patsy.
He was a patsy.
Clearly inside job of 9/11. I'm sure you have worked with that 8:46 a.m. chart.
Yeah.
So that, I said to Rick Levine the morning that it happened, like he somehow was like the first person that I talked to, and I said, this could only be the Mossad and the CIA. You look at the job, that's all it could be. Giving a lot of credit to government work to say that, but...
Look at the buildings falling in their footprint.
And Building 7.
Yes.
Falling in its footprint without an airplane strike.
That's right.
But why do you need one when everybody's been watching airplanes hit buildings and buildings fall down all day? Well, what's an extra building at 5:20 in the afternoon? It falls down. And we'll forget the part about the countdown on police radio to the thing and clearing the area for a demolition, and everybody seems to have known about that then. And I'm with you. Complete inside job. And that rather tricky Mercury rising in a mixed reception to Saturn in Gemini. It's kind of a mutual reception situation where you've got a exalted planet that rules, exalted in Libra, and the ruler of Gemini in one another's signs in an exact trine. That's a very important aspect of that mutual reception quality. They're in an exact aspect. Cornelius doesn't use that. He gets results. But the aspect strengthens things. The aspect is in the old books. Holy shit. Talk about your friend becoming your enemy and your enemy becoming your friend and who the hell is who.
Well, we had a bunch of Saudi patsies who weren't on the planes, by the way. I looked, the very first day, I looked at the passenger lists on the net. There were no Arab names on any of the passenger lists.
You mean those people were added? Muhammad Atta was added?
No, they never even bothered to add them to the passenger list. I think if you go out and check the passenger lists on the net today, you still won't find any Arab names.
You mean if you look at the manifest for Flight 11, you won't find Muhammad Atta on that list?
That's right.
Okay, well, there's a lot of 9/11 sites out there that have that flight manifest. There was so much wrong with it. I mean, it is a test of what you can get away with. The only thing I liken it to is The War of the Worlds by Orson Welles.
Yeah.
A complete hoax.
One theory about why they had so much sloppy stuff, which made it easy to see, was that they were actually daring people to show it. They were showing off how much they could get away with.
Building 7 is impressive.
Yes, it is.
So we could go on and on about this. Dale O'Brien, you should talk to him. He's got a friend who's looked at, well, there's the microspheres in the dust that the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth have found. What Dale O'Brien's friend is saying is that the particles are even too weird for that, that there had to be some kind of a HARP-type machine or some kind of a quantum vaporization of those buildings that really is not even normal nanothermite or whatever they are supposed to have used to bring the things down, not the airplanes. An airplane couldn't do that. They hit too high up.
And the jet fuel will not melt steel.
Nor weaken it sufficiently. That building was held together by a frame around the outside. Very clever. Right. Very clever design. Designed to withstand multiple 707 strikes, the architect said. And the architect, one of them, was on his way to work and caught in traffic outside the tunnel in New Jersey, and he saw what happened to Building 1, to the North Tower. And did you ever read what he said?
I hadn't heard that story.
What he said was, he looked at it and he said, "Wow, that's going to take a long time to fix." He did not say, "Oh shit, the whole thing's going to fall down." So I've gotten very little in the way of flack. I've told the 9/11 story about 20 times. I don't shut the fuck up about it, and I will not ever shut up about it. And no one's really complained when I've said, look, this is an inside job. Here it is in the astrology, and here it is in the physical world. But I'm wondering when the impact of that is going to take hold. Is it just too big?
When Americans stop watching American Idol and sports and stuff. In other words, never.
Yeah. And no, you know, who has the, I think the only, I've seen Dylan Radigan challenge it.
Right.
I never saw Olbermann challenge it. I never saw Rachel Maddow, never saw Jon Stewart, never saw Stephen Colbert. None of the most depended upon voices of, quote, truth on the American left. It is the third rail. They will not touch that one.
Some people refer to them as left gatekeepers.
Left gatekeepers.
Right.
Right.
Now, I'm an anarchist.
Yes.
I have no brief for the left or the right, conventional left or conventional right.
Right.
So it's a whole different story from my point of view.
Right. I think Colbert of those, just to give my opinion on this, is the one who is the most radical of them all,
Probably.
I think. I mean, to get up there and to put his shoe down Bush's mouth in person, I thought that took some balls.
I've never owned a TV.
You'll enjoy it. It's on YouTube if you watch it. And they think he's a conservative commentator. And the quote, one of my favorite quotes is that, you know, he lambastes the press for saying, you know, you people will never be happy. He goes after the press also, and he says, you know, you demand changes in personnel, and they give you changes in personnel, and then you accuse them of rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Which is true, of course.
And he said, no, that's a terrible metaphor. This administration is soaring. They're rearranging the deck chairs on the Hindenburg.
Ah, yes, I like it.
That's brutal. I mean, you know, and then he goes on for 20 minutes like this and lives to tell the story. So, Colbert.
There is something to be said for being well-publicized. It can extend your life expectancy.
Yes, it can, being in the spotlight. Yeah. Yes. And being funny helps.
Yeah.
And the other thing, anyway, he's got both. So so we're going to have a mess on Election Day, you're thinking.
Yes.
And we should be prepared for this. And
prepared to if you're a serious political junkie, just reconcile yourself to twiddling your thumbs for about a month and a half.
But if you want to question the system or see the nature of how it works, get ready to save all your newspaper clippings and peer between the cracks.
Or you can just lean back and laugh, which is what I'm going to do. And I'm leaving the country in December, by the way.
Like you're expatriating?
Yeah, I'm going to South America, which I've been wanting to do for many years.
Did you buy a little piece of land down there and disappear?
No, I'm going to be a permanent tourist for a while.
Got it.
Until I get tired of that, and then there's a city in southern Brazil that I like that I'll probably go live in.
All right. Even more South America. Well, no, even south of Central America. Brazil's South America, right?
Yeah, right. I'm going to Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, and Brazil.
All right.
In December and January.
Awesome. I'm sure you'll have a lot of fun checking things out down there. So let's see now. So we talked about the elections. The Mercury shadow storm, did we do that yet?
We didn't talk about that yet.
Okay, so you're the person who popularized, you said, not invented, the concepts of Mercury shadow and Mercury storm.
Right. The shadow comes from basically Roxana Muse. And to some extent, Terry Lamb. Roxana has been on the lecture circuit for many, many years, using graphic ephemerides to illustrate the concept of the shadow. And she's very good. But somebody pointed out that there's something else going on, which is that right around the change of direction, right around the station, give or take a few days or weeks, things get really weird. They don't immediately get totally weird just when Mercury enters the front-end shadow, and they don't stay totally weird until it leaves the back-end shadow. But right around the stations, things are really strange.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody called that the storm. It was an article in the Arizona Society of Astrologers Bulletin years ago, an anonymous short article, and I have asked for people to identify the author, and nobody has. But anyway,
do you know who it is?
I have no idea.
Ah, you don't know who it is.
I have no idea.
It may not even be living anymore.
Right. It could be an anonymous dead person, for all I know.
And it was when does this come out?
Probably in the 1980s or 90s.
Okay, so it's not that old.
Not that old.
And it was in the Arizona
Society of Astrologers Bulletin.
I see.
Out of Phoenix.
Right.
Yeah, but I picked up on that, and I've been because I'm very sensitive to Mercury. I have Mercury stationing direct 6 hours after my birth. So I picked up on the importance of the storm, and I've been using it, for example, in the calendar that I do for Llewellyn, which has the moon's opportunity periods in it. I also emphasize the Mercury storm. I don't even talk about the shadow in that calendar particularly.
Right.
If you want to find out about the shadow, I do have an article that I redo every year that appears on my website, and you can go look at that.
Mm-hmm.
But I really emphasize the importance of the storm because that's like a week or more before the retrograde station, and that's when things start really screwing up.
And how do you define that? Is Mercury's average daily motion being under 1 degree?
Being under 40 minutes.
Under 40 minutes.
Under 40 minutes of arc, and that's purely empirical. I have no idea why that should be so, but that's just what appears to work.
Right. Okay. All right. So I found this to be a pretty useful concept in terms of working with Mercury stations and Mercury retrograde in general. And I've seen all kinds of strange things happening with Mercury retrograde. So there's an effect that I've noticed where things seem more or less normal during the retrograde, and then in the second shadow phase, it's like you get the whole thing coming on like a herd of horses.
Now, you can also have a period right around the middle of the retrograde, when Mercury is conjoining the sun. It's what's
called, as it is today,
the inferior Well, this I believe is the superior conjunction, where Mercury's on the other side of the sun right now in direct. But there's the inferior conjunction of Mercury to the sun, where Mercury is between Earth and the sun.
At the peak of the retrograde.
Right, that happens right in the middle of the retrograde. And it's right around then that I think Phil Sedgwick pointed this out years ago, that you can get the feeling that everything is going to be normal for a while. And you may even be able to pull off some things as if Mercury were okay, but in a very short few days or so, it's going to go back to being chaos again.
Right. So that combustion to the sun can, unlike what the ancients say, they don't like those close conjunctions of the sun and Mercury.
Right. They don't like close conjunctions of the sun with anything.
Right. Unless it's within 11 arc minutes.
Well, 17 minutes.
Kazemi is 17 arc minutes?
17 minutes,
okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, Kazemi. Kazemi is wonderful. Unless there's an eclipse or a nasty transit.
What does the word Kazemi mean?
It's Arabic. I don't know what it means originally.
But for us, it means within 17 arc minutes of a conjunction.
In celestial longitude, yeah. A conjunction to the center of the sun. Now, the reason for this, at least partly, is that the sun's apparent diameter on average is 34 minutes.
Ah.
So 17 is half of it. So you're within the disk of the sun in celestial longitude.
Okay. So there's some logic back there from their old guys making measurements way back in the year zero, whatever, before negative zero. Right. Okay. Well, thanks for passing on that Mercury shadow, Mercury storm information. Now, let's just check out one thing. This Venus retrograde is in Mercury-ruled sign. Are you noticing any Mercury retrograde type effects with that?
No, but I never noticed Mercury. I never noticed Venus retrograde. I'm not a Venus person. I have friends who are ruled by Venus who notice Venus retrogrades big time.
Right.
And I'm not noticing any Mercury retrograde-like effects at all.
Okay, good. Just thought I'd check on that because it's in a Mercury-ruled sign. And what's your thoughts on the transit of Venus?
Well, I haven't lived through one, so.
You lived, 2004.
2004, with that exception, yeah. And I really have no opinion on it. I'm waiting to see what happens, if anything, just like everybody else. I am very empirical.
Yes.
I don't make up my mind what's going to happen based on a priori reasoning. I wait to see. I want to look back in history and see what's happened.
Right. And see some results.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, we don't have a lot of that with Mercury station on Election Day. We only have that one other example, and bad things happened.
Yes, they did.
So we'll keep an eye on that. Now, in your professional practice, you're a locational astrologer.
I do a number of kinds of consultations, including horror and electional, natal, and predictive. But my real specialty, you could say, is relocation and travel. Both relocation and travel. I help people pick, quote, permanent, unquote, places to live. I'm a Buddhist, so I don't believe anything is permanent.
Right.
And I help people pick places to take vacations, which will change their upcoming periods. And that means, like, the week before your birthday, the week before your solar return. I use precession-corrected returns for those of you who know what the difference is.
Right. Okay.
And yeah, I use precession-corrected returns for both the sun and the moon.
So that advances the solar return by a little bit.
It means that it occurs half a day later if you're 36 years old and a full day later if you're 72 years old.
It makes it further out.
It makes it later.
Yes, okay.
Yes, yeah. So I have used precession-corrected returns in my own life since 1970. I used to hand calculate 56 of them per year for myself, 4 for the sun every year and 4 for the moon every lunar month. I hand calculated them for 13 years. Then I started using Neil Mickelson's astro computing services to do them. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, I do them in SolarFire.
Yes, much easier. Saves us all a lot of time.
It saves a lot of time.
And knowing what sign things are in more accurately, potentially. Yes.
Yes. But I got good at hand calculating them. It's not that bad.
How fast could you hand calculate a natal chart with 9 planets in it you were done?
If I was going to interpolate the positions of all the planets and cusp to get exact, and then it would take me probably half an hour or more. But if I was really whipping on a good day with my mind not foggy, and return charts, you don't care about interpolating the planets and cusp to the minute of arc. You don't need to.
Why don't you?
Because all that matters is whether the planet's in an angular house or not.
Against the natal or against the...
Against the return chart itself.
Okay.
I'm using Donald Bradley's method. The old sidereolist had a book called Solar and Lunar Returns. It's a wonderful book. It's out of print, but you can still get it.
Yep.
And that's the method that I use. It's called the foreground method. It comes out of the sidereolist school. If a planet is conjunct to one of the four angles of the chart or in an angular house, it is powerful. That's called foreground. And right. If it's in or next to the cusps of the succedent houses, that's called middle ground. Cadent is background. Anything succedent or cadent is unimportant and can be ignored except for the sun or moon, which you always notice. You always interpret the sun and moon by house, wherever they fall. Aside from them, you look only at planets in angular houses or conjunct the angles.
Right.
That's called the foreground method of interpretation.
Okay.
And it becomes very powerful. For example, next month, June, I happen to have my birthday, and it stinks. The solar returns chart stinks in San Diego, where I live. But in Virginia Beach, Virginia, it has Venus-Jupiter conjunct straddling the ascendant. So I'm going to be visiting Virginia Beach for the first time in my life.
And have you found that that works?
I've been doing it successfully since 1973.
You mean picking the place to be for your
right.
solar return, so that's your
not,
chart?
Not just solar returns, but fractional solars, quarters and halves. And I've traveled using the lunars. And I in 1985, I went to Saudi Arabia and worked for about a year. And after that, I spent 10.5 months traveling in Europe and South America, and I timed my travels insofar as possible using the lunars and fractional lunar returns, and it all works.
Right. And you get results, is
you
what
get,
you're saying.
You get results. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you a story. I was in Curitiba, Brazil, and I saw an upcoming quarti-lunar that looked like illness. You can tell an illness chart in a precession-corrected return. So it looked like I was going to be very sick for a quarter month, a week. So I could have conceivably, if I had been rich, flown to the western side of the continent for a week, and then I would have had to fly back to avoid being sick the next week. Couldn't do that. So instead of staying in the third floor walk-up where I was staying, I moved to a hotel where I had a room within walking distance of the front desk, central heating, hot and cold running water, a hot shower in the room, and I was half a block from a grocery store. And I survived the week. I was sick as hell, just as predicted by the return chart, but I survived the week.
Right, because you gave yourself that advantage environmentally.
Right.
And work with it.
Right. And these charts are extremely useful.
Right. Well, I'm going to pay a little bit closer attention to them now.
Good.
You know, I have not made a big practice of solar return charts. I do other... I'm more of a progressions person?
Oh, I do both.
Mm-hmm.
When I do a predictive consultation, which is actually most of my business, what I call lifelong issues and current issues, I interpret the natal chart, that's the lifelong issues, and then I look at four predictive techniques. I use secondary progressions for 5 years ahead, and then for 1 year ahead, I use three techniques. I use minor progressions and outer planet transits, and then the four quarter returns of the sun for the year.
And assemble a picture out of that.
They get all the info, and they get it on a tape.
Right.
Whether they come to see me, which a few of them do, or whether we do it over the phone, which I do with most of my clients, but they get the tape.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it's live conversation, so both voices are on the tape. So
right.
I want to hear their questions. I want it to be interactive.
Yeah, and it's good that they hear what they say also, I think. That,
right.
that they bring a lot of the best information in, just intuitively or by what they're guided to ask about.
And, you know, I like to ask questions, too, as an astrologer. I don't regard it as a party game where I'm supposed to guess what happened in their life. That's not what it's about. It's about helping the client.
Yes.
So there's nothing wrong with asking questions.
Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts on Chiron?
I use Chiron. I originally resisted it. I don't like cluttering up the chart. But some years ago, a client of mine got in a car accident. Her boyfriend at the time was driving her sports car and totaled it, and her ribs got broken. And I looked at her chart in retrospect for that accident, and nothing worked except natal Chiron. So since that moment, I have used Chiron.
What was the? Do you remember the aspecting
no.
to Chiron? But it was a Chiron type event.
It was a wound physical moon in this case, and it does, it involved aspects, transits to her natal Chiron. That's,
right.
That's all I remember.
Got it. Okay. Yeah. And that got you on the scent.
Yeah. So now I use Chiron. I look at it in every chart. For some people, it's more crucial than others, depending on the aspect pattern. I know a whole bunch of healers who were born in that long period in the 1950s when Chiron and Uranus were opposed for years and years
yep,
and years.
Yep, 50s and 60s. Yep.
Yep. Hmm. Yeah, and one way of expressing that is to be an unorthodox healer. I know a chiropractor who has massage people, all kinds of healers
yep.
who have that opposition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it seems to be pretty high voltage, and not everyone is able to handle it well.
Well, I'm sure that's true.
You know, it's a lot of energy running through.
I get my clients are ones that handle it well, fortunately for me.
Right.
Yeah.
Got it. So you're drawing off the top of the barrel there.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
All right, so what else? Anything else on your mind? Anything you want to say to our readers? I'm very happy to introduce you to Planet Waves, Planet Waves folks. You're always in the background of my thoughts, and I so far have not, you know, run you up the flagpole till now. So,
well, thank you.
Yeah.
Well, like I said, I'm not only an astrologer, I am also a Buddhist and an anarchist. Some people think that's pretty weird combination. But all three of them are related in that they're looking at descriptions of how the world really works that are not available to the average person.
How would you define anarchy for people who are not familiar with a kind of more mystical version of anarchy rather than breaking windows?
It's not, well, okay, breaking windows is force. Anarchism comes from the Greek an, which is negative, and archos, meaning leader. So it's no leaders, no rulers. And as for the breaking windows, the black block, the so-called anarchists.
Black block, yes.
If you look at their shoes, they're all nicely polished black shoes. Straight police issue. Those are cops, man. Those are provocateurs. They're not anarchists. You can find that in any demonstration where the black block shows up and starts smashing stuff.
Look at their shoes.
Yeah.
They're
police agents.
Okay, yeah. That's, most people don't want to do that kind of thing. It takes a lot of motivation to do that. So, but anarchy in its...
Well, if you're getting a paycheck for being a cop,
that's good motivation.
Yeah.
Now, anarchy in its more authentic sense.
You go back, one of my favorite anarchists was Peter Kropotkin. He was born as a nobleman in Russia and became an anarchist out of intellectual conviction, freed his 1,200 serfs. He wound up serving prison time in both Russia and France. He's a very interesting character. He was a scientist by training, wrote a book on cooperation called Mutual Aid as a Factor in Evolution, or Mutual Aid, a Factor in Evolution. Wrote it, I think, before the First World War, and you can look it up. It's a wonderful book. It was going against the kind of negative social Darwinism that claimed that you know, it's the toughest guy who wins. It's not the toughest guy who wins. It's the person who can handle change the best. And that includes cooperating with other people to handle change.
And that's anarchy in your mind?
Yeah, it's all about cooperation. The first basic principle of modern 20th century American anarchism is what's called the ZAP, or NAP, zero aggression principle or non-aggression principle, that I decide that I will not use force or fraud against you. I will not initiate force or fraud against you. I'm perfectly willing to defend myself, but I will not initiate force or fraud against you.
Right.
So this is not the same as being the kind of pacifist who lies down and begs to be beaten. That's not what it's about. It's about everybody taking care of themselves and cooperating with each other in doing it.
Right. So there's a high level of personal responsibility involved in anarchism.
Absolutely.
Right. That's always been my impression of the way that you can get by without being told what to do is you have to know what to do.
Right.
In astrology, we'd say you have to have internalized the Saturn principle yourself. You have to take over your Saturn.
Right.
What's your Saturn like?
My Saturn is in Gemini, conjunct to Uranus in Gemini. I have a stellium in Gemini. Uranus and Saturn are in early degrees, and then Mercury and the ascendant are conjunct in middle degrees.
Mm-hmm.
And so in Saturn and Uranus, depending on your opinion about rulership, are the rulers of my midheaven.
Which is in Aquarius.
In Aquarius, right.
Right.
And since both of them are in Gemini, I always have two careers. You can blame it on Saturn in Gemini, or you can blame it on Uranus in Gemini. I've always had two gigs.
Right.
I've always been a part-time astrologer, and I always did something else, whether it was cab driving, postal work, computer programming, systems analysis, or whatever.
Yep. Well, and you're natal Gemini, or you're...
I'm a Cancer Sun.
Got it. Okay, so, but a lot of planets in Gemini will also grant that ability to have diversity. Yep. But you've got the two, the modern and the ancient rulers of your 10th in your ascendant, and they're both there. So you have two strong points of identification.
In common Western astrology, they're in the 12th. They're well up.
Right.
But if you use whole sign, of course, they're in the first.
Right. And I straddle both of those systems.
A lot of
just
us do.
Based on experience... That whole sign houses are pretty interesting.
So is Coke, though.
I always use Coke houses. Now, tell me why I finally, after trying basically every house system, I settled on the Coke house system without really understanding why.
Joyce Wehrman said things go better with Coke. But if you if you go read the Huber system, they discovered empirically that Coke works.
That the cusps are more sensitive?
Right, right. Are you familiar with the Huber system?
I'm not.
Okay. Bruno Huber and his wife Louise were Swiss astrologers and developed a timing system called the age point, which starts at the ascendant. And then you have 6 years per house. And they discovered that if you use the Koch houses, it works apparently perfectly. And they also have another interesting phenomenon that I've found. A few degrees before the next cusp, there is a little point called the low point of the house, and that's where the planet is most powerless. And in my own work, my own relocation, I have a very nasty Neptune in my chart, but where I live now in San Diego, Neptune is on the low point of the fifth house, which is the weakest place it's ever been in my life, and it is doing me less harm there.
Ah, so you've weakened a planet that acts malefically.
Right.
By placing it in a relocated chart, and you're saying that it's going to be just outside... the 5 degree zone.
Well, I happen to use personally. I use 7 degrees clockwise of angles, 5 degrees clockwise of succedent cusps, and 4 degrees clockwise of cadent cusps. And this is consistent with medieval practice.
Most people don't know those terms, by the way. So the angular ones are the houses that follow the midheaven and the ascendant. The houses that are on the angles of the
first and seventh, tenth and fourth
are the angular.
Right.
Then
the succedent would be the second, fifth, eighth, and 11th.
Equivalent to the fixed signs, but not really. But in that position between.
Right.
And then the cadent houses are the third, the sixth, the ninth, and
the
12th.
Right.
Right.
And this would be very medieval. Lee Lehman told me that Bonatti used 7, 5, and 3. I use 7, 5, and 4. But it's just an impression of what I seem to be see working.
Right.
But to me, if it's just before that little spot where it would be conjunct the next cusp, that's the low point. And that, according to my understanding of the Huber system, that matches what they were talking about.
Inside that range before?
No, before.
Right outside that range.
Just outside that range.
Right. So Lily, for example, in Christian astrology says that the cusps are sensitive out to about 5 degrees ahead. The planet starts to act like it's in the next house.
Yeah, well, he was taking an average.
Yes.
The opinion in the Middle Ages tended more toward like 7, 5, and 3 or 7,
Got
5,
it. So, so it as the house weakens, the orb will shorten.
Right. The weaker houses get smaller orbs, if you want to call it orb. The ancients wouldn't have called it orb, but we can think of it that way, orb to the cusp.
Yes. Okay, and then so you're saying when it's outside that zone, just outside that zone, the planet is in a compromised state.
The Hoovers call it low point of the house. And the planet is weak.
And that's kind of the opposite of the cusp of the house, which is a peak. The cusp is not really the border of the house. That's a misnomer.
Right.
And it's drawn as a black line in the chart. That's not quite right. It should be more of a fuzzy line. And from what I understand from Schmidt, the cusp is actually a peak point in the house,
right,
as calculated maybe like by making an exact aspect to the ascendant. So if my ascendant is 12, the houses might cusp might peak out at 12 degrees. Is that?
Well, if you that house would, yeah. Now
the ascendant would. So, for example, if the ascendant's 12, that would be the peak of
The energy of the first house.
So it is on the ascendant,
right? It energizes if there's a planet conjunct the ascendant. I happen to have Mercury 3 degrees above my ascendant, and I learned very very early on that it was not a 12th house Mercury. I don't care what the heck anybody has.
Right.
It's a first house Mercury.
Right.
And I'm working with return charts for years and years and years, I see planets just clockwise of house cusps, very, very powerful if they're angular cusps that they're conjunct to. And you see a planet 4 or 5 degrees clockwise of the second house cusp, and it has no power. Because in a return chart, using the Bradley-Fagan technique, the planet loses power when it gets to that point.
Right. Very interesting.
Yeah, it is.
Good technique stuff. Thanks. This is how I've shoplifted most of my education, is having exactly this kind of conversation.
You and everybody
over
else.
Over and over again for 20 years, yes. Awesome. Good. Jim Chabon, a pleasure to have you on Planet Waves FM. Please do come back sometime, and I'd love to hear about your travels as you embark upon them, United States descends into the other kind of anarchy.
Yeah, chaos. Chaos and anarchy are different, folks.
Yes.
Anyway, I'm going to be in South America as of the middle of December, so... you can contact me from there.
Awesome. We'll have your web address next to your interview.
Yes, and I will have my website's not going to change, and my email address is not going to change.
Yes, as they don't need to. They're non-local.
That's right.
All right. So thank you again. You're listening to Planet Waves' continuing coverage of the United Astrology Conference, or rather, as I've evolved into saying, the people at the United Astrology Conference here in New Orleans, Louisiana. Today is the 27th of May. We're wrapping up this conversation at exactly 1:30 p.m. Central Time. Thanks for listening. Catch you later in the day with another update. Bye for now.